Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, saha vidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti, narayanam namaskritya narayanam, naram chaiva narottamam haram dhyam. Devim Sarasvatim Jaiva Devim Sarasvatim Tato Jayamudirayeta Tat Pithamahadyam Pravedanti Shashtam Pithamahadyam Maharshimakshaya Vibhuti Yuktam Maharshimakshaya Narayana Syamsha Jameka Putram Narayana Syamsha Dvaipayanam Vedanadhim Namami Dvaipayanam Vedanadhim Namami. Very good. Welcome back. We're continuing our study of chapter 268. It's counted from the beginning of the Shanti Parva. And we introduced in a previous class this samvada, this dialogue. We have so many dialogues. Of course, the major dialogue is a dialogue between Bhishma and Yudhishthira. Who is that? Gosh. The whole of the Moksha Dharma Parva, as we've discussed before, is a dialogue between Bhishma and Yudhishthira. Yudhishthira, who goes to Bhishma at the end of the war for spiritual advice. But within that dialogue are many other dialogues. And the current dialogue we have, Bhishma is narrating a dialogue between Mandavya, a great rishi, and King Janaka, the great king of Mithila, who was distinguished as a Rajarshi. We had this discussion in the last class. Distinguished as a Raja who is a rishi. What a rare combination for a political leader to be spiritually wise. And we spent part of the class ruminating on that. And perhaps you share with me a longing, if only. If only our governmental leaders were more driven by spiritual values and less driven by politics and self-interest. We had that discussion in the last class. But we're ready to pick up the thread. To help us pick up the thread, let's just review the last verse we saw in the last class. We already saw this. A very surprising statement to come from a great king, Janaka, who said, Susukam Javjivami. He said, I would live very happily, yasya me nasti kinchana, if I had nothing at all. If I had nothing at all, I would still live happily. Mithilayam pradeepdayam, even if this entire city or kingdom of Mithila, even if it were pradeepta, burnt to the ground, even if my entire kingdom were burnt to the ground, name dahyati kinchana. Very interesting choice of words. If the entire kingdom of Mithila were burnt to the ground, nothing of mine would be burnt. Those are his exact words. If the entire kingdom of Mithila were burnt to the ground, name dahyati, nothing of mine, kinchana, at all, would be burnt. That shows very clearly that Janak did not consider Mithila to be his, quote, kingdom. Of course, that would be the most natural thing. My kingdom. After all, he's a Raja. He's a king. So he's going to say, my kingdom. The problem with that my is attachment and identification. These are fundamental spiritual problems. And certainly you can say that mamata, that minus we discussed in our last class, that mamata, that minus is natural to be attached and emotionally engaged with your own country is absolutely natural. It's absolutely ordinary. But we've discussed on several occasions that these teachings are not about being ordinary. Attachment is ordinary. Myness towards your possessions is ordinary. But as we've discussed before, we have a chance to do better than being ordinary. We can be more than ordinary. And certainly Janaka was more than an ordinary king. An ordinary king is very much attached and identified with his kingdom. And just to show just a kind of a pragmatic example of how mamata, how identification even with one's country can lead to such trouble. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the terrorist attack of 9/11. And if we reflect back on the days immediately after the attack, it was very clear that it wasn't merely an attack on the World Trade Center and on the Pentagon. It was an attack on the core of America. We felt personally attacked. And certainly our leaders in Washington felt personally attacked. Natural. You say, of course, we were attacked. Absolutely, we were attacked. It was a horrible, horrible thing. But here's the problem. In a time of crisis, is it better to emotionally react, have this gut reaction, this gut response, or is it better to reflect very carefully and rationally and with a clear mind? Is it better to reflect on what would be the best course of action? Most of you would agree that the latter, to reflect with a very clear mind, undistorted by emotional reactions, would be the best response. Is that how we responded after 9/11? We as individual persons and we as a country and our governmental leaders, it was a very emotional response. The invasion of Iraq and of Afghanistan and Iraq, these were very emotional responses. And looking back, it's very possible that some of those responses were inappropriate. That's for historians to argue and politicians, not for a Swami to argue. But it's possible that some of our response, certainly a response was appropriate. After all, our country was indeed attacked. But my question is, was this country's response as appropriate as possible? Could our response possibly have been more appropriate if there was less mamata, less identification with this country? Remember, it's that identification that draws us into the emotional turmoil. Even here, King Janak says, if his entire country were burnt down, I'll extend on his words, he would not have an emotional reaction. Nadakyatime, nothing of mine would be burnt, he said, which means he wouldn't respond emotionally. Does it mean he would remain passive? No, that's not what he's saying. He's only saying that he wouldn't take it as a personal loss, and then he would be able to go ahead and do the right thing untainted by emotional reactions. So Janaka, as a Rajarshi, as a Raja who's a Rishi, as a king who is spiritually, not just spiritually wise, enlightened. So he could make the best decisions under any possible circumstances because he was freed from this emotional reactivity. And just when we reflect on our response after 9/11, I don't think we can say that about this country's response. And there is then a price we all pay, a price that the world pays for any mistakes that are made. So King Janaka is certainly a remarkable king, and he is King Janaka in this whole chapter now, is giving a lecture to Mandavya, this great rishi, and the topic of this discussion, this samvada. The topic is the problem of mamata, myness, identification, attachment, possessiveness. That is a problem, and how to deal with that problem. How to come to Janaka's perspective, where he could rule a kingdom, he could be responsible for the kingdom without having a sense of attachment to it, without having a sense of ownership. And therefore, he could do the right thing under all circumstances. Let's see how he continues this topic. Okay, the next verse. Artha kalu samriddhahi, artha kalu samriddhahi. Badham dukham vijanatam, badham dukham vijanatam. Asamriddhastvapi sada, asamriddhastvapi sada. Mohayantya vichakshanan, mohayantya. The language here is very nice. Artaha kalu samriddhahi. See, suppose, artaha, suppose you're possessions, artha, wealth, we'll take it in this case. Suppose your possessions, samriddhaha, were to increase, were to expand. Maybe some of you were watching this the stock market last week, like a yo-yo. Suppose it only went up. Suppose the stock market went up by 1,000 points last week. Suppose. Just watch it go up. Artaha samriddhaha. So if you have investments in the stock market, you would then observe your artha, your wealth, samriddha, expanding, growing, becoming more wealthy. He says, kalu, indeed. Suppose that's what you observed. You're thinking, yeah, that would be great. How wonderful that would be. That's not what King Janaka says. King Janaka says, Badham, certainly, dukam. What? That would certainly be a problem. Huh? If your wealth expands, badham dukam, that will certainly be a problem. Really? Vijanatam, for those who are wise, for those who are truly wise, more wealth can be a problem. And this isn't just kind of spiritual fluff. You know, you think, oh, that's just what spiritual people say. They're trying to convince us. You ever think you're being manipulated by all these spiritual teachings and people? Oh, they're trying to convince us. It's not a matter of convincing. These are statements of fact. More wealth from a certain perspective is a problem. Vijanatam, for those who understand clearly, that's what the word means, for those who are wise, more wealth is a problem. Why? The more you have, this is a very fundamental principle. The principle is called yoga kshema. And in English, it means the more you have, the more you have to take care of. That's what the principle means. Yoga means acquisition. Kshema means taking care of what you've acquired. The more you have, the more you have to take care of. If you have two cars, you have twice the maintenance problems. If you go from a 2,000 square foot home to a 4,000 square foot home, you have twice the maintenance problems. It's just pure mathematics, is it not? And even if the increases in money, so now the stock market went up 1,000 points, now you've got this stock portfolio that's suddenly worth twice as much, and now you've got the burden of making sure it continues to be invested as wisely as possible. You have this additional burden now. Should I move it to different stocks? Should I take it out? Should I do this? Should I do that? I'll tell you something very honestly. As a young man, when I was earning money long ago, I had to make a decision about how to invest that whatever money I made as a young engineer. And I had some money, not much, but something. I made a very deliberate decision in those days not to invest in a stock market. But it wasn't a financial decision. It wasn't at all a financial decision. And those, if I had put money in a stock market then, this is in the 1970s, then in spite of the market's ups and downs, I would be in good shape today. It would have been a beneficial investment. I chose not to for a very deliberate reason. I was already studying Vedanta in those days, and I had already decided that I don't want to be worrying about the stock market every day. I don't want to be thinking about my investments all the time. So I chose not to do that at all. Because this is one of the problems of wealth. The more wealth you have, the more you have to take care of, the more possessions you have, the more you have to take care of. This is a problem of yoga kshema. Again, yoga means acquisition, kshema means caring for whatever you've acquired. Therefore, Janaka boldly says, badham dukham. This is certainly painful. This is certainly a source of suffering, vijanatam, for all wise people. More wealth is not necessarily a blessing. Now, bear in mind, more wealth means over and above what you already need for your basic needs. Please, let's not be naive to the extent and think that all forms of wealth are evil. Give away all your wealth. Money is evil. Wealth is anti-spiritual. That's not what's being said here. What's being said here is if one car will suit your needs, having a second car is not an improvement to your situation. If one car meets your needs. If a 2,000 square foot home meets your needs, 4,000 square feet is not an improvement. Again, the principle of yoga kshema, the more you have, the more you have to take care of. But if you have no car, that's a problem. If you have no house, it's a bigger problem. So let's not be naive here. We require whatever we need to make sure that we and our families and everyone involved to make sure that we have a healthy, stable living situation is an absolute requirement. That's not what Janaka is talking about. What Janaka is talking about is artaha samriddhaha. When the stock market goes up 1,000 points, when you double the size of your house, etc., etc. This is what we're talking about, is the vast expansion of wealth. Then he makes a very almost sarcastic comment. In the second line, he says, asamriddhaha tu api sada mohayanti avichakshanam. So the first one said vijanatam, for wise people they understand that increasing wealth for its own sake is dukkham, a problem. Then in the second line, he says, avichakshanam, at the end of the line, for those who are not wise. Vijanatam, for those who are wise. Avichakshanam, for those who are, to use my guru's term, wise and otherwise. So these are the otherwise. Avichakshanam, for the otherwise, for the not so wise, they are sada mohayanti, they're always infatuated by things. Naturally, if you're not wise, you look and you see the advertisement on TV or you see the new thing in the store window. So you can understand that people who are not wise, they can become easily infatuated by buying things or acquiring things. But the sarcasm comes here is that the not-so-wise, avichakshanam, they sada mohayanti, they're always getting infatuated by what? Asamriddhaha tu api, even by very trivial things, even by things which are not worthy of being acquired. This term, asamriddha, things that are, what's the opposite of valuable? Worthless, useless, trivial. Just a comment comes to mind. When the United States economy is in a little better shape than it is today, often it's in good shape. Lately, it's not been in good shape. But when the economy is in fairly good shape, a lot of people engage in a very interesting form of recreation in this country. Recreation, like going to sporting things, like going out dancing. But a main form of recreation in this country is shopping. Recreational shopping. You know this perhaps better than I do, that there are people who go out to the mall when they need nothing. I don't get it. They absolutely don't need anything. The house is already full of so much junk. They don't need anything, but it's Saturday afternoon. They have nothing to do, bored. What do? Grab the credit card, jump in a car, and go to the mall, walk up and down, go into a dozen stores, and buy a bunch of stuff. Why? That's recreation. Shopping as a form of recreation. Does that sound appropriate to you? Yet, I think you'll agree, it's a fairly common practice. Again, not when the economy is not good, then there's less of that. But when the economy rebounds, you can be sure that kind of recreational spending is going to thrive. That we can be sure of. And that's what Janaka is sarcastically referring to here. He says that avichakshanam, those who are not very wise, those who are very worldly in their outlook, they sada mohayanti, they're always getting infatuated or interested in even asamriddha, even very ordinary, trivial things. Because, admit it, when you go on recreational shopping, you don't come back with a giant big screen TV. Usually, recreational shopping is for these little things, useless things. How many useless things do you have in your home already? And then as part of this recreational shopping, you go out and buy more. And then you may not do this, but some people do this. Every several years, they'll have a yard sale. So all of this useless stuff that they've bought over the last 5 or 10 years, they'll put it out on their front lawn, and they'll sell it for 1/10 of what they paid for it. This is just silly, anyway. Even Janaka thinks it's silly. Okay, we'll come back to that. All right, next verse. Yatcha kama sukham loke, yatcha kama sukham, yatcha divyam mahat sukham, yatcha divyam. Trishna kshaya sukhas yaite, Trishna kshaya sukhas. Narhata shodashim kalam, narhata shodashim kalam. Yatcha kamasukam loke, yatcha divyam mahatsukam. Kamasukam is a happiness you get from fulfilling desires. Why do you go to the mall? Why is that recreation? But for me, that would be torture. I would be so uncomfortable and out of place in a mall. I would not find that pleasant. But many people, what is it about going to a mall and buying trivial, useless things? What is it about it that makes it pleasant or recreation? It's not merely time pass. You walk, you see something, and then you want it. Kama. And then when you buy it, you get the happiness now of fulfilling a desire. This is conventional wisdom about how to get happiness. How do you get happiness? Fulfill desires. If you have one desire and you fulfill it, you become happy. 10 desires, you fulfill them all, become 10 times happier. Fulfill a small desire, be a little happy. fulfill a big desire, become really happy. This is kama sukha. This is a happiness that comes through the fulfillment of desire. Of course, there are bigger and small desires, bigger desires. Suppose you get even bigger desires. So kama sukham loke, in this world, you can acquire, you can have so many desires and fulfill them all. What is the biggest desire you can imagine? Think of really big desires. How about having a $10 million mansion, having a dozen exotic cars, you know, going on a round-the-world one-year vacation, whatever. You think of all these really big desires. You can have the desire and fulfill a really big desire. It's going to be a lot of happiness. But there are even bigger desires. Suppose there's a desire for swargaloka. That's what the second half, going to heaven. So yatcha divya mahatsukam. You can have mahatsukam. You can have even greater happiness. What kind of happiness? Divyam, celestial happiness. In addition to fulfilling worldly desires, you can fulfill a divine desire for going to heaven. And in that way, you can have even more kama sukha. Nice expression. Kama sukha, again, is the happiness you get through fulfilling a desire. That word suggests a very fundamental mechanism for getting happiness in life. Fulfill as many desires as possible. And doesn't it sound like a very conventional worldview? Most people think about it. My goal in life is to live as comfortably and happily as possible. Therefore, I will fulfill as many desires as possible. This is a very common worldview, very ordinary, to go back to that word. This is the ordinary worldview, and it's horribly flawed. Before we see the actual solution, let's take a few minutes to dismiss one fundamental wrong assumption. In the very word kama sukha, it suggests that happiness comes from acquiring something. You fulfill a desire, you get something. Is it really true? We're going to spend 10 minutes examining this. This is very fundamental to the teachings of Vedanta. In fact, this is very fundamental to life. We all seek happiness. And the biggest irony, we seek happiness, we don't truly know the source of happiness. I'm not kidding. The most universal principle of human behavior is everyone seeks happiness. How ironic it is that we don't have a clear understanding of the source of happiness. So when you acquire something, is that object truly a source of happiness? And I've told this story several times, but not for a while, so allow me to retell this story. Few of you have heard this, but it's a delightful story. I was talking with a group of kids about a related topic, and I asked the kids, what makes you happy? And one kid says, ice cream. Loves ice cream. Fine. I ask them, you go to the store and you have one scoop of ice cream, how will that be? I'll be happy. If you go to the store, I asked them, if you go to the store and you have two scoops of ice cream, how will that be? I'll be twice as happy. If you have three scoops of ice cream, three times as happy. I asked this boy, if inside the case, they have these 5-gallon containers of ice cream. So I asked him, if this is a true story, I'm not making this up. I asked this boy, if you ate that 5-gallon container of ice cream, how would that be? The boy actually said, that would be awesome. He really said that. Oh, we all laughed so much. It was great. And the boy, poor boy, would be so sick before he got halfway through that 5-gallon container. But this really shows a fundamental confusion we have about happiness. Is happiness an ingredient in the ice cream? If it were, then 5 gallons of ice cream should make him ecstatic. Happiness is not an ingredient in the ice cream. You're thinking, well, Swamiji, we already know that. Of course. If you look on the label, it says milk, then it says sugar, corn syrup, more sugar, etc. And all of these, and then it comes to the ones that the ingredients you can't even pronounce. But you look through that whole list, you're not going to find happiness there as an ingredient. So you're thinking, Swamiji, we already know that happiness is not an ingredient in ice cream. Yet, many people, if not most people, have some deeply held belief that objects can indeed be the source of happiness. Before we pursue this, let's be very clear. Ice cream is not a source of happiness. No object is a source of happiness. You understand that well. But now, just to reflect on this, remember a time buying a brand new car. The first time, a really nice car. Not a cheap one. You got some money together and you could buy yourself a really nice car. The first time you got into your really nice car and drove it, how did you feel? Tell me, at that moment, did it not feel like the car was a source of happiness? It felt like it. It was, what a nice feeling. My car. And it smells, it has that nice new car smell, and it's clean. It'll never be this clean again for the rest of its life. And you drive this nice, shiny new car. It fills you with happiness. Now, we said happiness is not an ingredient in the ice cream. Is happiness in the car? Is it in the powerful V8 engine? Is that where the happiness comes from? Or how about from the luxurious upholstery? Is that where it comes from? You get the point. Happiness is not in the car. Yet, you feel like the car is a source of happiness. This, pardon me for saying it, is delusion. It's utter delusion to think any object is a source of happiness. Ice cream cannot be the source of happiness. That new car cannot be the source of happiness. The new house cannot be the source of happiness. And the birth of a grandchild, in and of itself, cannot be the source of happiness. This really challenges our basic assumptions about life. Now, all of these are happy events. There's no question. Getting a new car is happy. New house, happy. Grandchild, ecstatic, wonderful. But let us be a little bit thoughtful about this and understand more clearly what truly is the source of happiness. So now somebody will come along with a theory. This is a theory offered by psychologists. So now let's pick on them. So the psychologists will say, happiness occurs when a desire is fulfilled. So that they're smart enough to say that happiness doesn't come from the object, but rather there's tension inside. And that tension is because of the presence of a desire. And when you fulfill the desire, that tension of having the desire gets removed, and the release of that inner tension is what we experience as happiness. So this is a very psychological perspective on happiness that says, first of all, we admit happiness is not in the object, so then the happiness must be coming from me, right? So then the psychologist will say, yes, the happiness comes from you. Why? When a desire is removed, you experience happiness. Okay. Sounds good. Every time you fulfill a desire, you feel happy. So therefore, we're likely to conclude that happiness equals fulfillment of desire. Not the object, but the process of fulfilling a desire is a source of happiness. Is it true? Seems so, except not necessarily so. And these are topics that I have several stories that go along with these topics, so you'll forgive me for sharing one more of these stories, but it's just a perfect story, although we'll add to it a little bit. Suppose you were in a hospital room, suffering badly, maybe recovering from a terrible illness or recovering from surgery, but suppose you're really pretty miserable. I visit you in a hospital room, and to cheer you up, I tell you a story. I tell you a story about when I was a young man traveling in India. We were on a train, overnight train journey. There were a group of us, some Indian, some Westerner. And the following morning, a friend of mine on the train, he was a brahmachari and spoke with a very heavy Andhra accent, Telugu accent. And he was having a conversation with a young Western woman who was from Australia. So my Andhra friend had his heavy accent. This girl from Australia had her heavy accent. And early in the morning, they're having this conversation on the train. I'm sitting right there listening as they're having this conversation. My friend from Hyderabad says, so she's traveled quite a bit. So he asks, have you been to Thailand? Was his question. Have you been to Thailand? She can't make out his accent. So she thinks he said, have you been to, not Thailand, she thinks he said, have you been to toilet? And she's really embarrassed. She doesn't know what to say. Toilets on a train, you don't really want to talk about. So she's getting red. She doesn't know what to do. So she finally says, well, yeah. My friend from Hyderabad lights up and says, oh, how was it? Pardon me for telling these old stories again and again, but now look at the context. Remember, you were in a hospital room, suffering badly. I came in, and to cheer you up, I told you this story. In spite of your pain, you would have a good laugh. It's a funny story. It's a true story, too. So you would have a good laugh. You would have some happiness. Here's a question. If happiness is from fulfilling a desire, what desire did you fulfill laying there on your hospital bed? What desire? A lot of happiness came. What desire was fulfilled? None. This is some fundamental inquiry into the source of happiness that we never think about. And before we see what it's really, what the answer to this is, let's just reflect one last time how ridiculous it is for human beings to be engaged in a lifelong pursuit of happiness without being clear at all about what truly is the source of happiness. Doesn't that sound ridiculous? To spend a life in pursuit of something and not be clear about what it is you're seeking. So, let us now become clear. What truly is the source of happiness? It's not in an object. We dismiss that, ice cream. It's not the result of fulfilling a desire. We dismiss that with a joke in a hospital room. Then, what is the source of happiness? Well, look at the second line. Trishna kshaya sukhasya ete narhataha shodashim kalam. Trishna kshaya sukha. First we saw kama sukha. Kamasukha means fulfilling a desire. Here, it has Trishna Kshaya Sukha. Sounds very similar. Kamasukha, fulfilling a desire. Trishna Kshaya Sukha means happiness from getting rid of Trishna, a desire. Are those synonyms? Kama Kshaya and Trishna, I'm sorry, Kama Sukha. Let me just drop the Sukha, happiness. So one is Kama, fulfilling a desire, and the other is Trishna Kshaya, getting rid of a desire. They're opposites. Fulfilling a desire versus becoming free from a desire are opposites. Kama Sukha is the desire you get from, it's the happiness you get from fulfilling desire. Trishna Kshaya Sukha is the happiness you have in the absence of desire. Not by fulfilling it, by removing the desire. Not by getting the object of desire, but by removing the desire itself. In medicine, they say you're supposed to treat the symptom. I'm sorry, they say you're supposed to treat the cause and not the symptom, right? You know that very well. Treat the cause, not the symptom. Suppose we look upon desire as a symptom. If you fulfill a desire, you're treating the symptom. Suppose we go to the underlying issue, the underlying problem, which is the very presence of the desire. Trishna means desire, means longing. Trishna Kshaya literally means the removal of desire. Not the fulfillment of desire, the removal of desire, the absence of desire. Now, look to illustrate that. Go back to that hospital room metaphor. As you're laying there in pain, you feel pretty miserable. When you're feeling pretty miserable, what do you think? What goes on in your mind? I feel miserable. That goes on. But the other thing that goes on, I don't want to feel miserable. I'm miserable feeling miserable. This is what goes on in your mind. So there's an unspoken desire not to feel pain. You may not think about it in those terms, but obviously there's a desire to be pain-free. When you hear this silly story that makes you laugh as you're laying in bed, when you're laughing, this is very interesting. When you're laughing, the pain is still present. Pain doesn't go away. So you're laughing, and in fact, if the problem is in your gut, you'll laugh, you'll hurt more as you're laughing. So in spite of the pain, that if you've got stitches across here and you start laughing, it'll hurt more, and you'll go on laughing. Laughing in the presence of pain. How can you laugh in the presence of pain? This is very subtle and very fundamental teaching of Vedanta. Listen carefully here. It's a little subtle. When you're miserable in your hospital bed, there are two sources of the misery. One source is the physical pain. But there's a second source, and that is, oh, I feel so terrible. Oh, I feel so horrible. Oh, when will this pain go away? Oh, when will the nurse come with some more pain med? Oh, and you go on, and the mind just goes on and on and on like that. Here we can see the distinction between pain and suffering. We've discussed this before. Pain is a physical sensation. But a lot of what you're feeling there in the hospital bed is suffering. The source of the pain is inside your body. Where is the source of the suffering? If we define suffering as all of this complaining and worrying and self-pity. Oh, I feel so terrible. Oh, I can't stand this. Oh, I can't go on. What is that suffering? The pain is coming from your body. Where is the suffering coming from? Our own minds. The pain can be perhaps dulled with some painkiller. What about this suffering? What can make that suffering go away? Well, we already know one thing that can make that suffering go away, at least momentarily, a good joke. Look what happens. That joke is enough to put a temporary end to all that suffering created by our own minds. Of course it comes back, we know that. What is going on? That joke. Now, I think this is something in the philosophy of humor. The way jokes work is a principle of surprise. This is true in any kind of humor. There's an element of surprise. Surprise startles us. And when we're startled, we don't think of anything else. When we're startled, we're focused on whatever is happening right here and now. And the punchline of a joke startles you in such a way that all of that suffering and all of the thinking comes to a temporary halt when you get to that punchline. That's how that joke brought happiness in the hospital room. And it's not even that the joke brought happiness. All the joke did was put a temporary halt to this self-pity and all the suffering caused by your own minds. Which means, and now we're ready for the bottom line, happiness is not due to the acquisition of something. Happiness is the removal of something. This is so important. If happiness were getting something, then the ice cream, 5 gallons of ice cream, should make you ecstatic. Happiness is not the present. Happiness does not come from getting something. It comes from getting rid of something. In the hospital room, it had to do with getting rid of all the suffering caused by your own minds, all of the self-pity, or to put it in more Vedantic terms, non-acceptance of our present situation. This is a little philosophical, but this is Mahabharata class. Non-acceptance of your current situation is a source of suffering. Absolutely true. Yeah, it's a very strange definition. It's a definition you won't hear elsewhere, but it's a completely Vedantic definition. What is suffering in the most fundamental way? It's non-acceptance of your present condition. Suppose you could lay in your hospital room. No one is like this, but suppose you could have the pain and say, wow, that's really great pain. No one will say that, I know that. But suppose someone could somehow enjoy pain. Then they could lay in the hospital room experiencing pain, but be totally free from suffering. I know it's not realistic, but you get the point I'm trying to make. The point is that someone who enjoys pain is not going to feel non-acceptance of their current situation. But the fact is, none of us like pain. So in the presence of pain, chances are the response will be, this is not okay. I will be okay when this pain stops. Non-acceptance of a current situation, which is a fundamental cause for suffering. When that suffering comes to an end, what do you feel? Happy. When a joke comes, puts an end to this, all of this suffering. In the absence of suffering, what do you feel? Happy, content, at peace. Happiness is not getting something. Happiness is what remains in the absence of suffering. And this is pure Vedanta. You've heard many times the true source of happiness, as you understand already, Satchidananda Atma, your true self, Ananda, that source of contentment, peace, and happiness. It's already within you. And we've discussed before, what happens is the true source of happiness within gets obstructed by our minds, by our thinking, by the suffering that we ourselves create. And when that suffering comes to an end, when the obstacles or obstructions to the experience of happiness are removed, through that removal, what remains? The happiness, which is Atma Swarupa, which is your true nature. So here, King Janaka says, Trishna Kshaya Sukha. He talks about the happiness that comes not from fulfilling a desire, but the happiness that comes by removing a desire. Now, we're going to talk more about that in the coming verses. Fulfilling a desire and removing a desire are opposites. Fulfilling a desire means you get whatever you desire. Removing a desire means you don't get what you desire, but you remove the desire itself. Make sense? Instead of getting the object of desire, that's treating the symptom. How about you go after the root cause, the desire itself? And suppose you were able to remove that desire itself. That is the true root to happiness. That is kshaya, that is trishna kshaya, the removal of desire. And here, King Janaka says that and we have to put the whole sentence together. First line, he says, think about the happiness you can get lokeh in the world. All the kama sukha, all the things, all the happiness you can get from fulfilling desires, add that up. A whole lifetime of fulfilling desires, add all that up. And then, divya mahatsukam, think about the happiness you can get in heaven. Add that in. So the happiness from an entire lifetime of fulfilling desires, plus the happiness you can get in heaven, add all of that up, and according to Janaka, all of that, na arhataha, all of that is not equal to shodashim kalam. That doesn't even equal a 16th part. Shodashim kalam. All of that happiness through fulfilling worldly desires and even heavenly desires, all of that happiness is not even equal to the 16th part of the happiness you get from Trishna Kshaya, removal of desire. So he's pointing to a very fundamental source of happiness. He's calling here Trishna Kshaya, removal of desire, and he's saying that all other desires added up, all other happiness, the happiness from fulfilling desires, add all that up, na arhataha, shodashim kalam. It doesn't even equal a 16th part of the happiness that you could get from Trishna Kshaya, from removing desires. Now, how are we going to remove those desires? The chapter goes on. Before we talk about removing desires, maybe the first thing we should talk about is not adding to them. So removing desires will come. But we have a problem of if you've got desires, they say, are like rabbits. If you have two today, you'll have 20 next week. Desires are like that, and that's what's said in the next. So before we talk about removing desires, let's talk about avoiding having them multiply. Yataiva shringam go kale, yataiva shringam go kal, vardhamanasya vardhate, vardhamasya, tataiva trishna vittena, tataiva trishna vittena, vardhamanena vardhate, vardham. You can tell you're studying a text from ancient times when the common example is a cow, go. So in ancient times, not even in ancient times, if we lived 100 years ago in India, you know, we'd be living surrounded by cows, cow culture. So here there's a cow metaphor. He says, yata, just as, eva, indeed, just as goho shringam, goho means of a cow, the shringa, the horns, just like the horns of the cow, kale, in time, they vartate, grow. The horns of a cow grow, vardhamanasya goho. As a cow grows, the horns grow. This is the metaphor. Little cow, little horns. Bigger cow, bigger horns. So they get bigger. I don't know if that's really true, but that's what this verse says. So just as the cow grows, the bigger the cow grows, the horns grow along with the cow. Tata eva, in the same way indeed, trishna desires vittena vartate. Desires grow, vartate grow, vittena with wealth. The cow and the cow's horns grow with time. Desires grow with wealth? Do you know it's true? The more we have, the more we want. It's absolutely true. Think about when there was a simpler time in your life where you had very few things and your desires were relatively few at that time. And just think back to a time in your life when things were fairly simple. You didn't have a very complex life. You didn't have family. You didn't have all this stuff. So think about a simple, and if you didn't have that time, just imagine a very simple time in your life. You had a few things. You were fairly content. You had desires. Sure, you had desires. But the desires were perhaps few in number. How about today? Today you have so much. You have a nice home, car, house is full of junk. Sorry. Sorry, but it's true. So you have all this stuff, all this junk. Are your desires, how amazing this is. Having acquired so much stuff over the years, have your desires become fewer in number or more in number? That's backwards. You would think that over the years you've been able to acquire so much stuff that you would have relatively fewer desires, but it doesn't work that way. The more you have, the more you want. And that's what this verse is saying. As the cow grows, its horns grow. As your wealth grows, your desires grow. That's the metaphor. Tataiva trishna vittena vardhamanena vardate. Vittena vardhamanena. As your wealth grows, trishna vardate. Desire grows. It's just a fact of human nature. And it's ironic. You'd think you acquire so many things. What is the financial term? Zero-sum game. So if you have a finite number of desires and you fulfill half of them, you should have half as many remaining. That's math, right? Does it work that way? If you have 10 desires today, suppose you make a list. These are the things I want today, 10 items. And suppose in the next week or two, you fulfill 10 of those desires. I'm sorry, five. There were 10. You fulfill 5 of them next week. So I ask you next week, how many desires do you have left? And the answer will be 15. You have 10. You fulfill 5, and now what do you have left? 15. This is human nature. It's not math. We're not very mathematical beings, and that's what's admitted here in this verse. Amen. Let's see what's next. Janaka continues to give a spiritual instruction to Mandavya. He says, Kinchadeva mamatvena, Kinchadeva mamatvena. Yada bhavati kalpitam, yada tadeva paritapaya, tadeva paritap. Nashe sampadyate punaha, nashe. Very practical wisdom here. Kinchit evam mamatvena yada bhavati kalpitam. yada, when. Kinchadeva mamatvena. To the extent, kinchadeva, to the extent that you have mamata. And here we just have to note the Sanskrit meaning of this word. Please reflect on this. Mama is a Sanskrit pronoun, mine. That ta affix gives you the sense, of, like in English, when you put ness on a word, the quality or state of being. So mama plus ta or twa, both affixes have the same meaning. Mama ta, mama twa, they literally mean my-ness, the sense that this is mine. You can reflect on the conventional when the very beautiful Hindi word mamta, but look at the origin of that word in Sanskrit. Mamta in Hindi has a beautiful meaning, but mamata in Sanskrit does not have a beautiful meaning at all. It's talking about a very fundamental problem or issue, that sense of minus, that sense of possession. So, kinchadeva mamatvena yada bhavati, to the extent that mamata is present, and come back to kalpitam in just a moment, to the extent that mamata, mindness or possession, is present, tada eva pariptapaya, to the extent it's present, it will cause paritapaya, it'll cause suffering. To the extent mindness is present, to that extent, it will cause suffering when nashe sampadyate punaha. Whenever, whatever it is that's mine, whenever nashe sampadyate, whenever it's destroyed, whenever you lose what is mine, you will suffer. Naturally. If you lose your cell phone, as you many of you probably have. It happens. So if you lose a cell phone, you feel some suffering. If somebody else loses a cell phone, do you suffer? That's interesting. They could be identical cell phones. Same model, same features. They're both lost. And one is lost and one is not. Yours is not lost. The other one is lost. Do you suffer? No. But if the other one, if yours is lost, then you suffer. Now, this is amazing. If you took those two cell phones and put them side by side without looking at the address book, could you tell the difference? They look identical. So why is it that if one gets lost or damaged, you suffer, and if the other one gets lost or damaged, you don't suffer? One has mamata, the other doesn't. And now I'm screwing up my face because I don't understand. One has mamata minus, the other doesn't have mamatva minus. When you look at them, can you tell which one has? Is the mamata in the cell phone somehow? Where is minus? Ha. It's not in the cell phone at all. It's in our heads. We made it up. Kalpitam means we made it up. We decided this one is mine. Mamata is a projection of our own minds. And this verse says, to the extent mamata or mamatva is how it comes in this verse, to the extent mamatva is present, to that extent you are bound to suffer when nashe sampadyate, when that object gets destroyed or lost, you're going to suffer. So what is the solution to the problem? Is it possible to have a cell phone without saying mine? Now, let's reflect on this for a minute. We won't have time to go on to the next verse anyway. Some people are really attached to things, and especially if somebody gets the latest, BlackBerry or whatever it is. By the way, even though I have technological background, Now I'm completely out of it. I don't have any of this stuff. But you know people who are so proud when they get the latest state-of-the-art phone with all the keyboard and all the GPS and all those all the cool things and all the apps. And they want to do people do this? Do they show off to you? Does that happen, right? I thought so. Say what they want to show you their latest cool thing, and they want to show you all the cool apps they have for their cool thing. They're really proud of this because it's mine. Suppose your friend, having shown off their latest gadget, they lose it. Now, suppose it's not anything special. Somebody had to buy me a cell phone because I didn't have one. And it's a cell phone. It's got 10 buttons on it. That's it. And it doesn't do anything. It's a phone. It works just like a phone. That's all it does. If I lose it, I'm not going to worry about it. It's just a phone. Suppose we could come to have a more pragmatic attitude towards everything we possessed. It's just a phone. Okay? It's just a state-of-the-art BlackBerry. Okay? It's just a car. It's just a home. It's just life. It is possible to live in life without this intense sense of possession, possessiveness. My. If it's just a phone, if it goes, I'm okay. If it's just a car, not my car, it's just a car. If it's just a car and it goes, I'm okay. If it's my home and there's a fire, problem. If it's just a home and there's a fire, there's a situation to be dealt with. Notice the difference. This is my guru's language. If it's my home, it's a problem. If it's just a home, it's a situation. Problem versus situation. Situations we deal with, we handle. Problems make us sad. Problems make us suffer. And this is no joke, because after all, what did King Janaka said? He said, if my entire kingdom burns down, I'll be okay. It's possible. It's not ordinary, but it's possible. King Janaka can do it. If King Janaka can do it, you can do it. You can live a life free from possessiveness so that when you encounter losses, you won't suffer. That's the message of this text. There's so much more to see in the coming classes. We'll see that next time we meet. And next time we meet for the class will not be next week. Next week, I have to tell you, we're celebrating Janmashtami. And because of Janmashtami celebration, this class won't be held, but please come at 11 o'clock. We have a wonderful celebration planned, so come at 11. The meditation also won't take place. Come at 11, we'll have some puja and chanting. I have a nice pravachan for the occasion. After the event, we'll have some prasad, and you can. There's a sign-up sheet on the counter for bringing a dish of food. Please check to make sure that sign-up list gets all the way full, so that we can all enjoy prasad then next Saturday for Janmashtami. Other schedule announcements tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Gita at Work study group, which will meet here at 11 o'clock. You're very warmly invited. I'll continue the evening satsang tomorrow at 6 p.m. If it's raining, we'll meet inside. Otherwise, we'll meet outside. And then 2 weeks from today, Saturday, we hope to have the inauguration of our new dining hall. I say hope because we still have 2 inspections left, and anything can happen. So if the inspections go well, we should finish the remaining work, and that inauguration will take place at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today. This class will still meet, but the morning meditation will be canceled on that particular day. Very good. We'll conclude with our prayers and our tea.